The Tour of Torture, a demonstration about Canada's involvement in torture, took place in Ottawa last week. The tour was organized by Matthew Behrens.
What we're doing is we're trying to, in the way that this has happened in various countries that have dealt with torture in the past, is to identify those government agencies and private institutions and individuals who are complicit in torture. Because until we actually name them, until there's actual accountability for them and their actions, these horrible activities will continue on. So this is a part of the process of accountability and ensuring that what happened to people like Abdullah Al-Malki and Mouyad Nur ad-Din and Ahmed Al-Mahdi, who were all tortured with the complicity of the Canadian government, will not happen to anyone else. But part of that process is uncovering. So you see these big office buildings, and they're all very anonymous looking. But behind those windows, there are offices of embassies, of corporations, and of government agencies that are complicit in torture. And so this is part of the process of uncovering that.
Okay, and what were the reactions so far?
Well, the reactions from the public have actually been very supportive. People are interested when you ask the question, did you know that Canada is involved in torture? I think a lot of people suspect that something is up because they don't trust the government. But when you actually provide information, you say this came out of a federal inquiry and whatnot, you're helping people understand that this is the kind of activity that their taxpayers' dollars are actually paying for.
But does the media cover the subject?
No. And they've never covered it very well. In fact, they've done a job of actually participating in the violence by reprinting the lies that are made up about these men. So, for example, when Meher Arar came back and when Abdullah Al-Malki came back, the media was complicit in simply taking information from the RCMP and from CSIS and printing that in their newspapers without checking for the accuracy or the validity or the source of that information. So they too are part of the problem, and it's obvious as well because we've been here for 3 days and the only media who have come are people who are connected to the community, such as yourself and such as CHRY from Toronto.
Okay, and also you mentioned you've made some experiences with the RCMP during the protest. Can you talk more about that?
Well, starting yesterday, we were followed by the RCMP's community liaison individual. He did not identify himself. He was in an unmarked car without a uniform. And as Abdullah Al-Malki pointed out to him, that's exactly the kind of behavior that he had to deal with 11 years ago, and that led to his tarring of his reputation, and that set him up for torture in Syria as well. So we told the RCMP, we do not want you following us around. And they said, well, we're here for your safety. And we said, well, you're 10 years too late for Mr. Al-Malki and Mr. Al-Mahdi and Mr. Nur ad-Din. So if you're really concerned about safety, you will go back inside that building, investigate the crimes that have been committed by the RCMP, by your fellow employees, by your bosses, and you will do something about it. We haven't seen him since.
One of the things that we have been pointing out time and again is on this placard. And the placard says, and I'm just going to read it out for you here, it says, we simply cannot torture and preserve our democratic values at the same time. And we know that in the torture cases of Meher Arar, Abdullah Al-Malki, Ahmed Al-Mahdi, and Mouyad Nur ad-Din, the government has sought to get away with torture by making secret almost every document involved. We know that in the Arar inquiry, a huge portion of that inquiry was held in secret without Mr. Arar being able to be there, without his lawyers, the public, and the media. In the Iacobucci inquiry, no one was allowed to be there. It was the first secret inquiry in the history of the Public Inquiries Act. These men still do not have access to the tens of thousands of pages of documents. And so we're here in Ottawa today and yesterday and tomorrow to seek justice for these men. 3 years ago, the Iacobucci inquiry found that these men were tortured in Syria and in Egypt with the complicity of the Canadian government, with the complicity of the RCMP, of CSIS, of the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, of the Justice Department, of the Ottawa Police Department. They were all part of this conspiracy to target for torture these three Canadian citizens. Despite the findings of complicity in October of 2008, there is still no apology. There is still no compensation. There is still no accountability or criminal charges laid against those who are complicit in torture. And the government continues to take part in activities which make it complicit in that torture in a much broader range of cases. Some of you might know the case of Abu Sufyan Abdel Razak. Some of you might know the case of Ben Ammar Banata. Some of you might know of a refugee who was deported back to Ethiopia or to Sudan or to Mexico or to Hungary, where they will face torture or cruel and unusual punishment. That is something that takes place on a daily basis here in Canada, in a nation that deports annually 14,000 children, women, and men at a cost of $100 million. It literally is a factory which is taking human beings who come here seeking safety from persecution, safety from fear, safety from torture. We turn them around, we put them into a refugee system which is horribly outdated, which is horribly unfair, and then when they lose their case, we put them into detention, we put them on planes, and we send them back to face torture. And so, amidst all of this violence and anti-democratic secrecy and processes, we are thrilled to be here at Occupy Ottawa as part of this global uprising for what is right, for what is decent, for what is dignified. And your courage in being here is an inspiration to us. And when we realize that our route would intersect with your route, our hearts soared. We'll be going up to the War Department right here. It's not the Department of National Defense because it doesn't defend anyone. It wages wars, whether those wars are against First Nations here on Turtle Island or whether the war is the occupation illegally of Afghanistan, Iraq, or as we know, Canadian troops are currently in Djibouti and Senegal, among other places.
The demonstrators spoke in front of the Ministry of National Defense, where they read out a report from an Afghan translator who had worked with the Canadian forces.
Today we are here to talk about a very serious and grievous crime in which high up officials, way up there on the top floors, are involved. And that crime is complicity in torture. Now we know that the Canadian forces have tortured detainees in Somalia and Afghanistan, and today we're going to talk about the specifics of a number of those cases. So please welcome our friend from Toronto, who is going to now read about some of the crimes associated with the War Department and torture.
This is a crime scene. We should never forget the role in the torture and murder of Somali youth Shindane Aron, age 16. The ongoing detainee abuse scandal has effectively been swept under the rug by the very man, Frank Iacobucci, who prevented further damage to CSIS and the RCMP with his secret inquiry. The testimony of Afghan translator Ahmadshah Malgare indicates the extent to which Canadian authorities were aware of and consciously sent individuals to face torture in Afghanistan. The translator states, "I was employed by the Canadian forces as a civilian in Afghanistan from June 2007 to June 2008. During that time, I served as a cultural and language advisor. You can tell from my accent that I was born in Afghanistan, but I am a Canadian. I came to Canada as a refugee and studied at Carleton University. Ottawa has been my home since. In Afghanistan, I worked both inside the wire at Kandahar Airfield, known as KAF, and outside the camp in the dangerous Pantrai district and on dozens of patrols. I was on patrols hit by rifle fire and IED explosions. I risked my life for Canada's soldiers and the Afghan people. I earned many recommendations from the Canadian military and the Afghan government for my service. From personal experience, I know what is possible or impossible to say because of operational security. Nothing I will say today is a threat to the security of Canada, Afghanistan, or the soldiers with whom I proudly served. I'm here today because of my solidarity with Canadian soldiers and the Afghan people. I had a secret clearance and worked with several military units that handled or interrogated detainees. I translated many meetings and documents about detainees for DFAT, for the military police, and for the All Source Intelligence Center, known as ASIC. I also translated and gave cultural advice to high-level Canadians, such as the commander of JTF Afghanistan during Task Force Afghanistan, Brigadier General Guy Laroche, a man whom I respect very much, and also visiting ministers and members of parliament. What I learned in Afghanistan is that Canada often transferred innocent men to the NDS, and sometimes did so when the NDS threatened their safety and their lives. Let me tell some stories about the detainees. Please excuse me for the fact that some of the dates and details are approximate, but the Canadian forces took my notes when I left Afghanistan. Around June or July 2007, the CF forces raided a compound in Hazraji Baba, north of Kandahar City. During that week, a Canadian soldier shot a 17-year-old unarmed Afghan man in the back of the head. Shooting an Afghan unarmed man from the back violates the rules of engagement. The Canadian forces thought he had a pistol, but it was tested at Bagram Airfield and it was not his. Anyway, after the Canadian forces wrongly killed the man, they panicked. They swept through the neighborhood, arresting people for no reason. They arrested more than 10 men, from about 10 to 90 years old. All the men were taken to Kandahar Airfield, where I personally interviewed them with the Military Tactical Questioners Unit. None of the detainees were Taliban. None did anything wrong except to be at home when the Canadian forces murdered their neighbor. Yet Canada transferred all these innocent men to the NDS. I don't know what happened to them. Here is another story. Around July 2007, a detainee with battle injuries was in KAF awaiting transfer to NDS. Because he had medical needs, a meeting took place between two DFAT policy advisors, John Davison and Ed Jagger, the military police, and an NDS colonel named Yasin. I attended the meeting to translate. During the meeting, a disagreement broke out. Colonel Yasin said that NDS would not accept a sick detainee. When the Canadians insisted, Colonel Yasin removed his pistol, put it on the table and said, "Here is my gun. Go shoot him. Give me the body and I will justify it for you." I translated the NDS colonel's proposal to murder the detainee. Canada's government says detainees are never transferred to NDS if there is a risk of abuse, but this is a lie. The detainee was transferred to an NDS colonel who proposed murdering him while the military police and DFAT watched. When Colonel Yasin made his death threat, Ed Jagger immediately said, quote, "I will pretend you did not say that, and I will not hear it." Of course, pretending did not protect the man, but it is what DFAT and the military police did. I never found out what DFAT did to that man. Mr. Ota Mohammed Azsai was also transferred, but not easily. When Ed Jagger read him the detainee agreement and he understood that he was being transferred to the NDS, Mr. Aksgai became angry. He asked why he was being transferred. Mr. Jagger did not answer. However, Colonel Yassin objected that Mr. Yeager was telling the detainee his rights. Mr. Aksai protested that he had children and no money to bribe his way out of prison. Finally, he put his head on the ground and said to the soldiers, "Please put one bullet in my head. Do that instead of transferring me to the NDS." He was that scared of the NDS. Colonel Yassin answered. He told all of us, quote, "When Aksai gets to my room, he will speak." It was a clear threat to abuse this embarrassing detainee. There is one question I must discuss, the question of why. Why did Canadian officials ignore the abuse of the NDS? Or, like Mr. Yeager, why did they pretend not to see? When he testified, Brigadier General Thompson said that the NDS was, quote, "a very valuable partner," and that Canada, quote, "acted on the intelligence we received from the NDS." This is true, but not in a pleasant way. I saw Canadian military intelligence sending detainees to the NDS when the detainees did not tell them what they expected to hear. If the interrogator thought a detainee was lying, the military sent him to the NDS for more questions, Afghan style. Translation, abuse and torture. General Hillier did not tell the committee the truth. When a Taliban detainee is detained and is taken to NDS prison, the NDS knows everything about him because they will ask for the bribe. A dangerous Taliban commander, a dangerous element, can buy his way out of NDS prison. Known Taliban commanders walked out of NDS prison if they pay them. I told you the story about Hazraji Baba when over 10 men were arrested. They went from 10 years old to 90 years old. With all due respect, I would ask retired General Hillier to tell me and explain to me how a 90-year-old man, he was a 90-year-old man. He couldn't even walk without help. His hands were tied. His foot was shackled. He was blindfolded. Sometimes when he couldn't walk fast enough, they pushed him. He fell many times and he had injuries on his body. Could he please explain to me how this 90-year-old man, who couldn't even walk, who needed help when you tried to pick him up, could be a fighter? I have probably translated more than 40 or 50 of these documents. And these documents are actual detainee transfer documents that were given to NDS during the transfer. When I was translating this document, I always asked the tactical questioners, I said, quote, "Here you say that it's for further questioning by NDS. They should be transferred for further questioning. Should I translate this as transferring for questioning or transferring for torture?" And they would just laugh. The language is very simple here if you look at it. If they wanted to extract more information from them, if they were deceptive, they kept them longer and asked them questions until they were satisfied. If you can't get it out of them through a normal way, then you have to subcontract the torture. It's not the first time it has happened. We did it with Maher Arar. We subcontracted his torture. So why would anybody doubt that we would not do it with Afghans? There was no one in the Canadian military with a uniform who was involved in any way, at any level with the detainee transfers, who did not know what was going on and what the NDS had done to their detainees. This is a crime scene.
Abdullah Al-Maki was born in Syria and emigrated to Canada with his parents and three brothers in 1987 at the age of 16. Almaki is a Syrian-Canadian engineer who was imprisoned and tortured for 2 years in a Syrian jail after Canadian officials falsely indicated to the Syrian authorities and other countries that he was a terrorist threat. His arrest was based on information sent to the Syrians by the Canadian government.
With the Akpuchi inquiry, we got to know that they sent to Syria that I was an imminent threat on a certain day, and as if I was, you know, running around and away from them. And then we got documents through access to information that said the RCMP, in about a year before 9/11, they had an investigation, they wrote a report. Their assessment was, and I'm quoting their document here, Al-Malki does not seem to have committed any criminal offense, yet. And then it looks like they closed the investigation. Then 2 months before 9/11, another assessment in another report of the RCMP, they said he has not been found to be committing any criminal activities in Canada. So this is the second time that they're saying almost the same thing. And then just 1 week before 9/11, exactly 1 week before 9/11, they wrote in one of their reports, the assessment stated, there was one document before this one which they actually said we want to have the whole file reviewed extensively, and they had people reviewing the whole file. And this was the conclusion. They said, complete review of the file was conducted and discussions took place with Blacked Out, who is very familiar with the file. It does not appear to me that there is any offense being committed at this time that would warrant an investigation by ANSAS. Blacked Out has discussions with Canada Customs concerning possible import-export violations, but at this point there does not appear to be any violation. That was a week before 9/11. Then, 3 weeks after 9/11, an RCMP report said, which is on the exact same day that they sent to Syria and Egypt and other countries, that I was suspected Al-Qaeda member and poses an imminent threat to the national security and public safety of Canada, on that exact same day of sending these letters internationally to a good number of agencies, publicly known only Syria and Egypt, but there are a number of other countries as well, their own report, it said, O Division Task Force are presently finding it difficult to establish anything on him other than the fact that he is an Arab running around. So that's the date, exact same day. This is an internal document, while external documents when they sent to other people, other agencies, saying he's an imminent threat. So with these documents, and you could see the first document that we got until now, in the series of reports, it actually had, he has not committed any crime, yet, as if, you know, this person who's an Arab, he must be committing a crime, right? So, because it has been for the last maybe 7 years, everyone asks, why did they target you? Yakapuchi said in his report, when they said that I was an imminent threat, member of Al-Qaeda, suspect member of Al-Qaeda, an imminent threat to public safety and national security, he said that was totally baseless. So they basically made it up. But then it was always, and reporters always had the question, and not only reporters, even publicly, you know, you get people, well, why did they do this, right? And we didn't really have an answer until I got these documents. Now, maybe I didn't want to think about racism. 10 years ago, I never thought that I would be speaking about racism. I just never experienced racism in my life. I never had to deal with it. Not in school, not in university, not in work, not on the street. I mean, I never felt that I faced racism before. But, you know, to see it that the whole thing is built on, you know, there's nothing against him other than the fact that he's an Arab running around, was striking. Now, there are 17 other documents, which are police surveillance reports. They put descriptions of me, and then, you know, the height, the male, female, date of birth, age. And then there's a field about hair color. A lot of times they left it empty. But then there was a field about race. It says race. And in all these documents, the race was noted as non-white. So, you know, combine this with that, and I think it's clear that all what they had was they based it on racism from beginning to end.
Although a Commons committee subsequently recommended to apologize to Amaki and compensate him, the Canadian government, however, continues to deny any legal responsibility for Amaki's mistreatment.